This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 25 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I'm sorry that this thing is dropping on a Thursday and not a Friday this week. I hope you guys can forgive me, but I'm the best man at my buddy's wedding this weekend, so I'll be out tomorrow as I get suited up and enjoy a great weekend. I wasn't going to leave you guys hanging, though. We've got some great questions this week, so let's get to them. This first one is from Twitter, at MarkCN32. I have Freeman as a third-round keeper. How imperative is it that I get Tevin Coleman? What round should I draft Tevin Coleman in? I don't think it's imperative at all for you to get Tevin Coleman. If you haven't listened to the handcuff episode I did a couple of weeks back, I'd suggest doing that first and foremost, because the words spoken on there will be better and more detailed than anything that I could say here. But I do want to take this time to talk about the idea of owning both Tevin Coleman and Devontae Freeman. If you're drafting both of those players, you're essentially drafting them as starters on your fantasy football team. Freeman is a late first rounder, and Tevin Coleman is a late fifth rounder, and sometimes Tevin Coleman goes even higher than that. That type of equity is used for starters on your team. So let's look at what they did last year and run through an exercise. A season ago, and this excludes week 17 because it's worthless in fantasy football, Freeman had 11 top 24 RB1 or RB2 performances in PPR formats, while Coleman had 7. In addition, Freeman had 6 top 12 performances to Coleman's 4. That's a combined 18 top 24 performances last year and 10 top 12 performances between the two running backs. Now, Coleman missed 3 games, but in those 3 games, Freeman ranked 5th, 15th, and 17th in scoring, so you were getting more upside out of Freeman himself when Tevin Coleman was out. It was somewhat of a moot point. But let's give this whole scenario the benefit of the doubt and say that they'd have 19 top 24 performances had Coleman never gotten hurt, and 11 top 12 performances had he never gotten hurt. So that's one more of each. That means that per running back spot, you're looking at about 9.5 top 24 performances and 5.5 top 12 performances. Those are low-end RB1 numbers in both running back spots week in and week out. And of course, we're assuming that you're starting both of these backs each week given the investment that you would spend on these guys. That's certainly not god-awful production. If you were guaranteed what they did last year, you're not really hurting at the running back position. But that's also working off of numbers during a historically great offensive season in Atlanta. Regression is going to hit this year, people, especially for Tevin Coleman. I tweeted this out, but last year, a running back averaged a rushing touchdown on every 31.54 carries and 131.15 rushing yards. Tevin Coleman's rates, though, he scored a touchdown on every 14.75 carries and 65 yards. Tevin Coleman was essentially more than twice as efficient at scoring touchdowns than the average running back last year. And this doesn't even factor in his 13.6 yards per reception, which was the highest of any running back with 15 or more targets last year and the 6th highest that we've seen from a running back over the last 6 years. Devontae Freeman's rates are higher than average too. And the reason for that is because the Falcons were unsustainably good offensively last year. They tied Arizona with the 3rd most rushing touchdowns in football, all while scoring a touchdown on 35.2% of their drives. Only 3 teams had a higher rate of scoring touchdowns per drive over the last 6 seasons: the 2013 Broncos, the 2011 Packers, and the 2011 Saints. Each of those teams dropped below the 30% touchdown rate mark, which is still really, really good, the following season because of regression. This is what happened. This is math. I don't care how good you think Tevin Coleman is. Those numbers are not sustainable unless he gets a larger market share. But here's the thing. If he gets a larger market share, that means Devontae Freeman will get a smaller market share. So Freeman will become a less valuable first-round pick in fantasy football. This is why I can't get behind drafting both of these players. At their absolute best, they provided you with running back productivity that you still could have gotten from players on separate teams. But with obvious regression factored into the equation, you'll be lucky if they come close to that type of production. This next question is from Twitter as well, at @Michael_Dubner. In the sixth round or later, do you see yourself taking the Devontae Parkers, John Browns, those hype players, or under the radar guys like J-Matt, Cobb, Wallace, etc.? To be honest, when I'm drafting a player, I don't think about the hype much at all. That should all be built into how you feel about a player. Sometimes hype is warranted, sometimes it's not. It's on you to decide. For instance, I mentioned last week that I don't know if I see Devontae Parker's true upside as being that great. But I do like John Brown a lot this year because the Cardinals' passing offense is kind of a legit bounce-back offense. And there's some upside associated with Brown himself if this is finally the year that Larry Fitzgerald falls off. I like Cobb's upside because of the offense he's in. I don't love J-Matt because there are too many mouths to feed in an offense that could end up being somewhat conservative if Carson Wentz doesn't take a step. And Mike Wallace's value sort of dissipated a tad when Macklin signed with the Ravens just last week. So as you can see, without digging into the numbers and explaining exactly why I do or don't love those guys, I'm ignoring the hype or the lack of hype surrounding these players. I'm just looking at their situations and drafting accordingly. This next one is an email from Matt Culberson. He says, I've come to agree with your take on handcuffing studs. And for the record, if this is the first podcast that you've ever listened to from me, I'm not into handcuffing studs. But he continues, he says, but how do you feel about taking what are basically handcuffs not for injury insurance, but for owning the winner of a potentially ambiguous situation? For example, as a Keenan Allen owner, drafting Tyrell Williams late in case Allen's ACL isn't fully healthy or a third-year Tyrell ascends to outright dominance after a very underrated 2016. Or basically taking a late-round flyer on someone with actual upside that isn't tied directly to an injury, moving them up the depth chart. Dalvin Cook and Latavius Murray might be another example. CJ Anderson and Jamal Charles is another one. I've got a pretty blunt answer to this question. If you're describing these players as being risky and questionable in the first place, I think you have to question whether or not you want to draft them in the first place. Seriously, I think you have to ask yourself why you're drafting these backups in the first place when you're not even signaling injury potential. The Keenan Allen example to me is a straight up handcuff example in my eyes. If Keenan Allen is healthy, then you're probably not going to be starting both Tyrell Williams and Keenan Allen on your fantasy team. If Keenan Allen is technically healthy and playing, but he's not 100%, all you're doing is getting mediocrity then from both Williams and Allen. In other words, Allen's production dips a bit and Williams' projected production rises a bit, and now you're stuck not really maximizing your wide receiver spot on your roster. The same goes for Dalvin Cook and Latavius Murray. If Dalvin Cook doesn't perform, since we have no concrete idea as to how he'll look on an NFL field, then it's unlikely he'll completely disappear. You may think, oh yes, now I have Latavius Murray. But really, what you have is two running backs who aren't producing rather than one running back producing. So you could argue, I guess, that this is worse than handcuffing because there are strong chances that ambiguous situations become really bad. I'd much rather just draft Latavius without Dalvin Cook or Jamal Charles without CJ Anderson. Though I will say, I don't really want either of those guys this year. This next question is an email from Adrian Charlie. He says, hey JJ, still loving the show, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I love you too. I'm new to MFL 10s and have been waiting to grab quarterbacks late. With the exception of Breeze at 5.10, I couldn't pass that up. So far, I've ended up with Jameis at 9.12, Flacco 14.01 on one team, and Breeze 5.10 and Flacco 13.10 in the other. Looking for a temperature check on these moves, and do you recommend any other late round QBs in MFL 10s? Notice some players love grabbing 2 to 3 quarterbacks before the 10th, lol. Cheers, Adrian. In MFL 10s, I'm not really a big fan of going early with quarterbacks because win rates don't fluctuate that much amongst quarterbacks in the first place. As discussed on the MFL 10 pod on Tuesday, according to Mike Beers, who was on the show, Breeze's win rate last year, or the percentage of teams that he was on that ended up winning, was about 13%. But 9 quarterbacks had a win rate of 9% or better, which is why Beers isn't necessarily all in, as he noted, on a player like Breeze, despite him being a higher owned quarterback in his portfolio. As Mike said on the show, if you're going to go somewhat all in on these players, you don't want to do it at the quarterback position. And the reason for that is the general spread of win rates is just far larger at running back and wide receiver. The top running backs and the top wide receivers are giving you much, much more of an edge than the top quarterbacks. Granted, the top running backs and wide receivers are either going to be studs who you draft early or straight up values like DeMarco Murray. But that's where opportunity cost comes into play. There could be those types of backs that you're passing up on by getting those stud quarterbacks. And that includes Drew Brees. This is all mostly because of the same notion that I've talked about plenty of times in season-long leagues. You can get quarterbacks late, they're replaceable, and you're only starting one of them per week. With that being said, I think Winston and Flacco are totally fine. If you're going to do a large volume of MFL 10s, then you should diversify a good bit at the quarterback position, like I said. If not, just pick your favorite dudes. You guys know that I love Dalton this year, and if his ADP stays relatively the same, I definitely like Marcus Mariota and his weekly upside as well. Tyrod is viable, I think, and don't sleep on Carson Palmer either. This next one is from Twitter, at JustinFreeman18. Team wide receiver ones by ADP that surprised me. Corey Davis over Eric Decker, Corey Coleman over Kenny Britt, Cooper Kupp over Robert Woods. Which is the biggest travesty? I can understand the Coleman over Britt thing to a degree, despite the fact that the discrepancy between the two is probably too large. And I think the Corey Davis, Eric Decker thing will eventually correct itself as more content and news comes out. Speaking of which, I guess I'll take this time to talk about Eric Decker. I published my Eric Decker projection on Twitter almost immediately when he signed with the Titans. I've got him at 97 targets, 62 catches, 780 yards, and between 6 to 7 touchdowns next year. Those are all rounded numbers. It was good to see that my mentions didn't catch fire when I tweeted that out, but some folks definitely automatically assumed that Decker was going to be much more studly from a fantasy perspective. But this is why going through the exercise of projections is worthwhile. You can see that the Titans are a run-heavy team, and even though they added a really good veteran slot guy and a stud in the draft at wide receiver in Corey Davis, I'm not sure we can simply assume they're going to be that much more pass-happy in 2017. And speaking of projections, Justin Freeman, the guy who asked this question, is doing a really, really cool charity-related thing where he's giving out his Excel projection skeleton if you email him a $10 receipt to No Kid Hungry. It's essentially a spreadsheet that allows you to plug in what you think will happen, and it does the work for you, and you can build your own projections. You can look at his tweet, at JustinFreeman18 on Twitter. It's pinned on the top of his Twitter page. And then send him your $10 receipt, and he will send you a sweet, sweet resource. It's going to save you a ton of time if you're trying to build projections. But back to the Titans. Even if they are more pass-friendly, Eric Decker's volume isn't going to go up dramatically from a projection standpoint. You've got Delanie Walker there, Corey Davis is there, Rishard Matthews is there, and even DeMarco Murray is going to get some love through the air, as he did last year. This is actually a really, really good example of what I've talked about when I say an added piece to an offense generally doesn't mean good things for pass catchers who were already in said offense. Marcus Mariota will be in good shape this year, but it's going to be tough to predict Titans pass catchers week to week unless one of them gets hurt. But back to the question, the obvious answer for me is Cooper Kupp and Bobby Woods. I think Robert Woods is a really cheap 110 plus target guy in the Rams offense, but I still wouldn't necessarily advocate drafting him since that offense is going to be hashtag bad this year. But Cooper Kupp is going to be that low average depth of target slot guy in the offense. So maybe he'll catch more passes than Robert Woods, which would still be somewhat of a surprise, I think. But I have a hard time seeing him racking up the yards and finding the end zone in that type of role. But let's be honest, it's hard to envision anyone on the Rams racking up yards and finding the end zone. This next question is an email from Joseph Cott. I am very hyped on Joe Mixon. Can you talk a little bit more about the role you envision for him in the offense? And what do you think the earliest you can draft him is? My draft position is 4th overall in a 12-team PPR. I'm afraid that if I don't go for him at the 4-5 turn, I will miss out on him. Is the 4th round way too early? Thanks. Love the podcast, Joe. Thanks for the question, Joe. So just to be clear, Joe Mixon's ADP on fantasyfootballcalculator.com, which is a good place to see how maybe a home league will draft, his ADP is in the early 4th round. That may drop in PPR formats because of how people draft in PPR formats, but Mixon at the 4-5 turn isn't a reach at all. But yes, I like Mixon a lot. I think he's the honest front runner to be the best rookie running back this season in fantasy football, despite the offensive line changes in Cincinnati. There are already reports talking about Giovanni Bernard missing the first couple of games in the regular season after his ACL tear last year, which will get Mixon on the field ASAP. Even if we assume Jeremy Hill is a thing, Joe Mixon will still see the field. But Jeremy Hill also isn't very good. According to NumberFire's net expected points metric, Hill has now seen a lower than average success rate in each of the last two seasons after destroying that metric his rookie season. That's kind of a big deal for a bigger bodied guy. because he should be producing successful runs with each individual carry, whereas his efficiency might be lower. Think about a LeGarrette Blount. Think about a Jerome Bettis. I mean, think about a big-bodied running back and how they slowly grind out the yards. That's what Jeremy Hill's role is, but despite the fact, his success rate is still really, really low. So Jeremy Hill isn't that good. Giovanni Bernard could be still hurt. That's great for Joe Mixon. The downside to me is that Mixon may have trouble finding the end zone with Jeremy Hill there. But in a PPR format especially, that'll be fixed a bit with Mixon's role in the receiving game. According to my projections, Mixon is RB16 in PPR, but this is a classic case of how I don't look at my projections as gospel, really at all. That's with the assumption that Gio is fairly healthy and that Jeremy Hill has some sort of role. So it's not really capturing Joe Mixon's upside, where his upside is a legitimate RB1, guys. Joe Mixon could be an RB1 this year. I think he's got a lot of potential and a pretty interesting and electric offense this season. This next one is an email from Jeffrey Alfieri. I'm curious of your thoughts on Dez Bryant this year. Last year, I went 0 RB and ended up with Melvin Gordon and Blount as my running backs. But I missed the playoffs because my wide receivers were Dez, Allen Robinson, Moncrief, and Cobb. I've seen a few rankings, and Dez seems to be all over the place so far this season. Most people have him going in round 2, but I just saw him ranked on one website as wide receiver 36, which I find absolutely absurd. His touchdown potential alone is ridiculous, and I think another year with Dak will only do him some good. Let me first say that, yes, wide receiver 36 is absolutely absurd for Dez Bryant. But Dez has certainly been a divisive dude this offseason. I've seen people tout him as a huge value, and I've seen other people say that he's not even worthy of a second round pick. I'm probably more in the pro-Dez camp than I am on the anti-Dez one. The reason a lot of folks aren't on him is because of usage and the lack of Tony Romo. But Dez has been just fine in the past with non-elite usage, and Dak Prescott is pretty good at football. Let's dig into this though. Last year, Dez had 96 targets in 13 games, which prorates to about 118 targets. And he wasn't healthy all season long, even in the games that he did play. In total, had Dez played the full season, his market share would have sat around 24.5%, which is great for a wide receiver. Dallas also threw the third fewest passes last year. In my subjective but educated opinion, that number could easily rise this year. Dallas often played with a positive game script a season ago, starting each drive on average with a 2.8 point lead, which was the third best in all of football behind only New England and Atlanta. Obviously, when you're ahead, you're going to run the ball more. It's tough for a team to sustain that type of excellence, and any rise in pass attempts would create roughly 130 plus targets for Dez Bryant. And 130 plus targets for Dez means a lot of touchdowns over his career, and this includes his rookie season and that stupid 2015 where he played with complete trash at quarterback. Dez has scored a touchdown on every 11.5 targets. Let's round that up to 12 for argument's sake. Or how about, 15, because Dak Prescott isn't as good as Tony Romo for Bryant himself. Again, just for argument purposes. At 130 targets, that's still 8.67 touchdowns. And that's a very lenient 8.67 touchdowns. He scored 8 times last year in 13 games with a rookie quarterback under center. My model has Dez as a low-end wide receiver 1, so I think he's a decent enough value in that mid, late second round range. The problem though with him is twofold. He's not necessarily a weekly floor player, which is what you want out of your wide receiver 1, because he'll be more touchdown dependent than most top wideouts. And he also has some really, really tough potential cornerback matchups on the schedule this year. That's going to make him volatile as well. So if he falls to the late second after you get someone like Antonio Brown on your squad, I think he's a slam dunk pick. But when I'm constructing my team, I'd want a little more consistency out of that top wideout spot. And I'm not fully sure he's the guy you want as your wide receiver 1, despite the fact that I probably like Dez Bryant this year more than most fantasy analysts. This next one is from Twitter, @svosen. I've seen enough of Pierre Garçon to not be a believer. Who else on the Niners could I target to fade Garçon? First, I wouldn't feel confident in any San Francisco pass catcher aside from Pierre Garçon. I'm not saying that because I like Garçon. I'm saying that because the rest of their wide receiver group is as mediocre and meh as you'll ever find. Plus, why would you force yourself to invest in an offense that's not going to be very good? But I will say, I don't really understand the not being a believer in Pierre Garçon thing. Garçon's easily the best and most experienced wideout on that roster, and it's not even close. And he has a proven track record of being fantasy relevant. He's coming off a 1,000-yard season in Washington, and he's seen 100-plus targets in six of the last seven seasons on two separate teams. One of those seasons was in 2013 in Washington, where he caught 113 passes on 181 targets. 181 targets. That was with Kyle Shanahan as offensive coordinator, who, by the way, is now the head coach in San Francisco. That target total is the ninth highest target total the league has seen at wide receiver over the last six seasons, coming from Pierre Garçon. Garçon has been very fantasy relevant before. He was a low-end wide receiver one that year. There are definitely folks in the industry who are higher on Garçon than I am, because I don't think he reaches, say, 150 targets this year. I have him closer to 130 than I do 150. But I'm not a believer. And if I wasn't a believer, then I'd stay far away from the 49ers passing attack in general. This next one is an email from Daniel Meyer. Hey JJ, love the show and everything you put out there on Twitter. It's really helpful since I don't get much info anywhere else here in Germany and need to look for good fantasy football sources on my own. Guten Tag, Daniel. I took like 5 years of German in high school and college. I'm still really bad at it though, but I can at least still say Guten Tag. Anyway, Daniel continues. Heading into my second fantasy football season and my first hopefully well-prepared draft, I fooled around with some stats and ranks. I wanted to know which quarterback provides best value. Not really value, but you'll get how my brain works after reading this. So I simply divided my personal rank on every relevant quarterback by his current ADP. The higher the number, the less I want him on my team. Not really an expert move, but hey, I'm no expert. That's why I'm asking you. So Andrew Luck turns out to be my number one quarterback. He's ranked second, but has an ADP of 5.04. But I wonder why Derek Carr falls down to 22, while Blake Bortles is my number 11 in terms of value. How do you feel about Carr? Surely he should be a good option this year. Thanks and greetings from Germany. And please don't trash me if this is nonsense to you. Daniel. It's not nonsense, Daniel. I get the exercise. It's not necessarily how I would approach finding value, since the difference between a pick in round, say, 5 to round 8 is much more significant than a pick in round 9 to round 15 or 16, despite the fact that we're looking at 3 rounds instead of 6 or 7. But I think it's at least a way to find value, and I give you credit for that. But how do I feel about Carr, you ask? I think Carr is fine. But then you shared that ADP of 6.06, and I vomited all over my computer. So no, don't draft Derek Carr at that ADP, please. It really does not make any sense at all to draft him that early. Carr's fine as a fantasy quarterback, and I think he's in the QB1 range, but very few quarterbacks warrant that type of average draft position. And Carr himself was super, super inconsistent last year. He ended up with 7 top 8 performances, which is really, really strong, but he also finished 20th or worse in weekly scoring 7 times. That's not exactly what you should expect from an elite quarterback, given that cost. So overall, Carr is fine, but your exercise was right too. He's vastly overvalued. The last question is from Twitter, @SmithBK, Brian Smith. Discuss your career in podcasting. Was the Fantasy Fumble your first podcast appearance? If not, what was? Any horror stories? The horror story is if you go to lateroundqb.com and listen to any episode of Living the Stream. That's the horror story. In all seriousness, it's funny that you bring up the Fantasy Fumble, because that was my first podcast appearance back in 2012. I remember when I did it. I was nervous. I went up to my bedroom closet to record it. I was living in an apartment in Cincinnati with my now wife at the time. And I even drank a beer before doing the show to calm my nerves. As much as I enjoy social drinking, I'm far from that type of person. I'm not even one of those people who drinks during the week. But it was pretty bad overall. I was bad at podcasting. I was almost over-rehearsed and robotic. I had really thin skin. And this was all back in the day where literally everyone I came across, they argued with me that elite quarterbacks were awesome and that I was dumb. I'm not saying that as in I told you so. I'm saying that as in I was kind of thrown into this thing with people instantly coming at me. So I was always on offense looking to be one step ahead. But I think that that journey, all of that really helped me. It helped me realize that my approach needs to be logical all the time, that I need to be methodical and show my work. But most importantly, that I need to have fun with this thing. I'm really fortunate that my stupid ebook and a podcast appearance like that one were small stepping stones to get a job doing something that I love. And I just want it to be known to anyone listening that I don't take any of that for granted. As embarrassing as it is to look back at old tweets and old podcast appearances, there's no way I'd be talking to you guys on this podcast today without them. That got way too emotional for me, guys. And my life motto is to live your life like it's a romantic comedy. But that'll do it for me, guys. I hope you all enjoyed this week's mailbag episode. As always, you can subscribe to the Late Round Podcast by searching for the show anywhere you can subscribe to podcasts. And if you have questions for future mailbag episodes, feel free to hit me up on Twitter at LateRoundQB or email me at JJ@numberfire.com. Take it easy, guys.